Doppler lasers. I made a guess, and I think I'm dead wrong, and that is the moving particle, the light, the laser beam reflecting off of it. If I can measure what reflects back off of it, the Doppler shift tells me whether or not the particle is moving away or forward or toward me, that particular particle. And if they're only trying to make one particle at a time go to zero temperature, that's doable. If they got Avogadro's numbers of particles in that chamber, at first it sounds impossible to me. So how is a Doppler laser going to make all this work, Roy? AC2GS, K2LAW.
AC2GS. Okay. We all know about quantum physics. We all know that electrons exist in different energy levels, and photons of very specific energy are required to be absorbed for them to get raised to a higher energy state. They will not accept half that amount, a third of that amount, two-thirds of that amount. You have to give them all or nothing. So what happens if you have a laser that was tuned to the exact absorption spectrum of the sodium atoms, and now you tune it a little to the red? How would you think would affect a bunch of randomly moving atoms in a cloud having the laser projected at them that's a little bit redshifted?
It's only going to affect the atoms that are motion toward it, because they will see a positive Doppler and they think it's not redshifted. So I'm selectively addressing the ones that are moving toward me versus moving away from me. That's my guess. Roy, go ahead.
That's completely correct. So what you have effectively done is slow down atoms in that axis. Now, if you start to take a bunch of more lasers and point them at different axes, you effectively limit their motion using Doppler lasers. Now, there's a background thermal energy based upon eventually the electron drops to its lowest energy level, gives up momentum, but the momentum it gives up is random. So there's a background average kinetic energy that amounts to millikelvin. So you've brought down a gas that started at 700 degrees Fahrenheit into the millikelvins just using Doppler lasers.
Okay, and these sodium atoms or whatever, you're going to bring them down to nanokelvins, microkelvins, picokelvins. You're going to get closer and closer to absolute zero in absolute temperature, zero Kelvin. What is the motivation for doing that? Once I've got some finite number of molecules at very close to zero temperature, maybe I'm doing this for a Bose-Einstein condensate experiment of some kind, what's the major motivation here of trying to make the exact temperature, not average temperature, yeah, I guess it's got to be exact temperature, try to make the exact temperature go to zero? Why am I doing that, Roy? Go ahead.
Basically, it's still the average temperature. As you've stated repeatedly, the temperature is basically the average kinetic energy, not the absolute kinetic energy. I thought we might kind of dance around how we get the temperature even lower, and then we'll focus in on why we're getting the temperature lower, because we've only gotten it to millikelvins, which you can't do anything with, unfortunately. Scientists would really like to bring it down to at least microkelvins. And the next step is something that sounds a lot saner than shooting it with lasers, which most people would think would heat it up. And it's called evaporative cooling. So can you imagine how we evaporatively cool a cloud of very cold sodium atoms?
The evaporative cooling you and I are familiar with is when water sitting on the table evaporates. The portion of the water that evaporates creates cooling. When I climb out of the shower, the water that's evaporating off my skin makes me feel cold. So I'm getting cooling there because of a change of state, liquid to gas. These individual molecules we're talking about here, they're not starting off as a liquid. We're not converting them to a gas. So the evaporative cooling those words are confusing me in this environment, Roy. Go ahead.
True, because there's no phase change. But the underlying principle is very, very similar. What you effectively do, and the reason why everyone picks alkali metals as opposed to anything else, is because the next step is to have a magnetic field that contains the gas of either sodium or potassium or rubidium. It encloses it and holds on to it. But it leaves an opening for the most excited atoms to jump out as though evaporation works. So basically, it's a contained magnetic field with an opening for the higher energy atoms to be evaporated off. That brings it into micro Kelvin.
Am I doing this to make a very precise clock of some kind? Or am I doing this as a big science experiment to find out how Mother Nature behaves at zero Kelvins? What's my major motivation here, Roy? Go ahead.
Ultimately, it's a big science experiment. It's quantum mechanics written big, as opposed to most of the time quantum mechanics occurs in subatomic particles. Using this method, you can get millions of atoms behaving as a single act with a single quantum mechanical set of phenomena. That is much easier to evaluate than you can when it's subatomic particles. But there's one more step, because these scientists don't want to settle for simply microkelvin. They want to go bring it down to picokelvin, and for that they need near zero gravity. With that, they use something called adiabatic cooling, and I bet you can guess what that is.
That suggests cooling at a constant pressure, but the word pressure implies that some number of molecules are hitting the wall, creating a force on the wall, and we call that pressure. If these molecules are not moving, they're not hitting the wall, therefore pressure measured in pascals almost doesn't count. But maybe I'm wrong. Over to you, Roy.
Well, you have to keep in mind that the pressure, these are not things contained in solid objects like a beaker of water or stainless steel. These are things contained in a magnetic field. So by lowering the magnetic field at the right rate, you basically let the gases expand. And just like any other ideal gas, PV equal NRT, as you let it expand, its average kinetic energy drops. And so you can actually, they think, they haven't done it yet, but they want to do it, they want to see if they can bring it down to as low as 100 picokelvin. And that's why they need close to zero gravity. If you tried to do this in Earth's gravity, the cloud would simply drop due to gravity, and you wouldn't get any sample. But with this technique in microgravity, not only can you do it, but it can last much longer. These things usually last milliseconds. They're hoping for about 10 seconds worth. And also, you can stabilize their shapes because gravity isn't acting. So you can have a sphere of quantum gas, which you can do all kinds of fun things, which we'll talk about.
Okay, so if I'm using a magnetic field to confine some number of particles, it's almost like putting it inside of a beaker. So the magnetic field is containing the particles. If I can use my lasers and other techniques to lower the velocity of the particles while they are contained, and then by lowering the magnetic field, I'm no longer containing them, that is a kind of evaporative cooling. If they had velocity to begin with, if they had zero velocity to begin with, then lowering the magnetic field that's containing them might not give you cooling, because they don't have any desire to expand. If they're not bumping against each other by motion, see, ordinarily pressure is the molecules hitting each other and hitting the walls. If I've got them essentially stationary inside of a magnetic field, they're not hitting each other, they're not hitting the walls of the magnetic field, and I lower the magnetic field, Maybe I haven't done anything. Over to you, Roy, K2RAW.
Well, I guess if you could get something down perfectly to 0 degrees Kelvin, that would be quite correct. But you can't, because quantum mechanics won't allow anything to be a zero energy level. So there's always a little bit of kinetic energy in these atoms, no matter what you do. No matter what brilliant idea a scientist comes up with, you can bring them down to picokelvins, hopefully, but you can't bring them down to zero. Zero is one of those wonderful things like infinities. They just don't exist. So I agree with you. If it was a 0 degree Kelvin, it would have no effect, but then you wouldn't need it because it's already 0 degree Kelvin. But since it's non-zero degree Kelvin, the evaporation and the pressure decrease, they hope, will have an effect. They've tried the first two things on Earth. It works fine. The third one of the adiabatic cooling is a new little trick that they're going to try in free fall, and they're hoping that it'll work.
Do they have a prediction as to how much extra cooling this is going to give them? Will a millikelvin become a microkelvin by this effect if everything goes just right? Or is a millikelvin, does 0.5 millikelvin go down to 0.4 millikelvin? Over to you, Roy.
The Doppler lasers bring it down to 10 to 100 millikelvin. The evaporative cooling brings it down to about 100 microkelvin. They're hoping that the adiabatic cooling will bring it down to 100 picokelvin.
And if they can do that and hold it for some number of seconds, what's your guess as to what's next? Why are they doing this? Just to prove it can be done for a long period of time?
And we'll get to it right now. There are two types of particles in this world. I'm sure everyone's sort of heard of them, bosons and fermions. Bosons are light photons are bosons. The Higgs boson is actually a boson. And fermions are electrons and protons and neutrons and all that fun stuff. Now, the reason why those particles are what they are has to do with quantum spin. Objects that have a quantum spin of a half a number, plus a half, minus a half, are fermions. Whole number spins 0, 1, 2, 3, 4 are bosons. Bosons occupy the same space at the same time. You could have a billion photons sitting in the same exact place with the same energy, and the laws of physics are quite happy. You can't take two electrons or two neutrons or two any kind of fermions with the same quantum numbers and put them together and have them be happy. So that's a big difference between bosons and fermions. But particles alone aren't bosons and fermions. Complex systems are. Let me drop. In other words, what you're looking for is an atom that's a boson, which means that the total number of fermions, half spin, have to equal a whole number. In other words, that's why they pick these interesting metals like potassium 39 or potassium 41 or rubidium 87. If you add up all the neutrons and the protons and the electrons, it gives you an even number. An even number, 2 × 1/2, gives you a whole number. So all those atoms are bosons, and they can occupy the same place at the same time. If you bring them down to almost 0 degrees Kelvin, they merge together in a single quantum wave state, and they act as a single atom. So you have a million or 2 million or 10 million atoms all coalescing and, in the macroscopic world, acting as a quantum device. Let me drop. Now, you can do all kinds of interesting things with these types of quantum devices. One of the many things that people did with them already on the Earth's surface is use them to slow down the apparent speed of light. There's a professor, I think, in Harvard, who brought down the apparent speed velocity of light from its normal velocity in a vacuum all the way down to the speed approximately of a bicycle. While it was in that Bose-Einstein condensate, the apparent speed of a light propagated at a ridiculously low speed. And that's just one of many phenomena. It gives people an indication of quantum mechanics and how it relates to solid-state physics and how it relates to quantum computing. And you can even model how very hot compressed gases act in a similar way to very diffuse quantum gases. So quantum gases is a fascinating state of matter that's very new to us. We talked about a superfluid helium. Let me drop for a sec. A couple of weeks ago, I talked about all the fun things about helium, and one of the fun things about helium is if you lower it below a certain level, it starts to take on a behavior sort of like a Bose-Einstein condensate. It has a quantum vortex. It has an angular momentum in multiples. You can't do half or one-third of its angular momentum because it's acting as an entirely big quantum mechanical device. And now, superfluids aren't exactly the same as Einstein condensates because Bose-Einstein condensates are created from gases. Superfluids are created from fluids, and so they have slightly different characteristics. But a Bose-Einstein condensate is a fascinating structure for people to play with, and that's why scientists want to do this. Plus that instead of milliseconds to play with it, they're hoping it'll be stable for seconds as long as 30 seconds. That's their best guess of the best that they could hope for. So that's why they're bothering to get down to these temperatures, because that they want to be able to experiment with a new state of matter. And that's my spiel on the cool lab. Cool Atom Lab, and I have a place for you to go and look for that. If you go to cold.ac2gs.com, there's a very nice article. There's a whole series of articles, a website on NASA's Cold Atom Lab. It gets into all the details and all the fascinating experiments that they plan to play around with. They're going to try different types of Bose-Einstein condensates because they have sodium. They have potassium and they have rubidium. So they're going to try and put the rubidium and the potassium together once it's created and see the interaction of what that does. So there's all kinds of fascinating things that have to do with this cold atom lab.
Are the astronauts that are on the space shuttle right now already up to speed and skilled on the use of this particular piece of equipment? On top of that, have they made a prediction as to how many weeks, months, or years downrange they'll be getting some of the answers out of this particular experiment? Back to you, Roy.
I assume that they've gotten the documentation necessary to run the initial experiment. I don't know the time span of how long it'll take them to go from step one to two. These things go very, very slowly, unfortunately, as you may have noticed. That, you know, we talk about discoveries that are announced a week ago, but they actually happened 6 months, a year and a half ago. So, you know, science is a little on the cautious side, which I think is a good thing. So eventually we'll hear what they find, but they're not going to kind of run to the New York Post the minute something happens. They're going to sit there and think about it and write some papers and get it interviewed, and then eventually it'll be released to us poor guys, and we'll have to make some sense out of it.
Yeah, a good example of that is the very first LIGO gravity wave detection of those two black holes that collided. I think from the time they saw the event in September until they officially announced it to us next March or something like that, it looks to me like they studied it and studied it essentially for 6 solid months before making the announcement as to what they thought it was and what it all means. Because it's such a brand new field, it does make some sense. You don't want to put a whole lot of egg on your face right away, particularly after running this experiment, which I think is the most expensive thing that the National Science the major National Science Institute in the United States. I think it's the most major event they've ever financed. Over to you, Roy, K2LIW.
Yeah, all things considered, I prefer if science is kind of slow and steady rather than looking for press releases. Every so often, I'll read these weird stories and hunt them down in their press releases from universities. And they're not so much research papers as just the guys who are public relations for the universities are trying to trumpet how smart their people are. And so I tend to discount that, and I wait for the actual peer review articles, because that's usually where you get the real stuff. The other stuff is just the flotsam and jetsam.
In the case of a radio wave traveling through something like a coaxial cable, you've got a certain velocity factor, which is a function of the amount of capacitance, so to speak. And that, as the amount of capacitance gets higher and higher, the velocity gets smaller and smaller. Can I call a Bose-Einstein state a super, super, super capacitor because light travels so slowly through it? Over to you, Roy, KQIW.
I don't know. When it comes to quantum mechanics, it's very difficult to kind of do a one-to-one comparison with macroscopic objects. And so you usually, it doesn't really translate that well. Some people will say, aha, you said that the speed of light is a constant and light can only travel at the speed of light, so how come it's going so slow? Well, you notice repeatedly I say the apparent velocity. So there are phase interactions going on within the Bose condensate that produce interference patterns that that end up having, from the outside, the velocity slow down. But most likely the velocity is the same inside. It's just being subjected to a lot of very, very complicated phase interactions.
Do they ever discuss the apparent permittivity of a Bose-Einstein state?
I don't think so, because, again, we're talking about structures that have only lasted for about, I think it was something ridiculous like 15 milliseconds. They're not long-lived in Earth's gravity, so who knows, maybe that's one of the many things. Although there's a laundry list of tests that they're doing, and a lot of them are very esoteric quantum mechanical ones. I think to run through a bunch of quantum mechanical concepts before they start to deal with the macroscopic principles of that. It would be fascinating to find all these things because, like I said, it's a new state of matter. You think of gas, liquid, solid, and sometimes you add plasma to the mix, but this is a whole other thing entirely.
Sounds like you're looking forward to the results of this particular experiment. You're waiting with a certain degree of excitement, hoping it comes out well, right?
Now, I mean, quantum mechanics is a very, very strange thing. I mean, Richard Feynman, I think, was the guy who said, if you think you know everything, if you understand quantum mechanics, it means you don't understand anything about quantum mechanics. So anything that gives us an inkling of how the heck this thing works, and this strikes me as a wonderful exercise if it follows from the theoretical, that you're going to have this big macroscopic playground that you'll be able to play around with quantum mechanical states without having to infer them based on statistical findings of subatomic particles in large cyclotrons and such. It strikes me as an interesting new way of observing quantum mechanics in real life in the macroscopic world, which is fascinating to me.
There are some predictions that a so-called quantum computer is going to be a great big step forward beyond Moore's law, so to speak. Is this experiment possibly going to support that kind of potential profit gain? Over to you, Roy.
Not directly, but indirectly it might. Quantum computing is another fascinating, although somewhat dubious, field, because there are quantum computers out there, but it's such a strange field that they haven't actually proved that they do anything particularly special. the concept of quantum computing is fascinating as a concept, which is that regular computers are basically von Neumann serial processing binary devices. There are ones, there are zeros, and computers manipulate symbols using ones and zeros. Quantum computers work on a different principle entirely. They are truly parallel. Now, when we say that regular computers are parallel processing, we mean there's a bunch of serial processors that are hooked up. But quantum computers are totally, utterly parallel in structure. They don't have any discrete bits. They have things called qubits, which are both one and zero simultaneously at the same time in superposition. So the idea is you run some kind of a program, it instantaneously works on every possibility, then collapses the wave function, and you get an answer. And if they ever are able to do it with enough qubits, all these prime number encoding schemes will be broken.
Has there been any real confirmable progress in quantum computing to date, Roy?
To me, nothing definitive. There are guys, there are companies building quantum computers. I think Google has a quantum computer, at least one, perhaps two. Universities have these. They're very primitive. They don't have a lot of qubits. So it's difficult to interpret what's going on with them. They're trying to build bigger quantum computers that have more qubits. As you double the qubits, you probably exponentially increase the power of these things. And we're not at the point where it becomes provable to everyone. You have to sort of be a believer in quantum computing, despite the fact that it costs millions of dollars to buy these devices, and you have to keep them at very low temperatures because they deal with entanglement and all kinds of quantum effects that don't operate at normal temperature.
Yeah, if my power distribution system, if all that wiring could be made out of superconducting cryogenic materials, I'd have no loss in my power distribution wiring. So if I build these great big computers that are also cryogenically cooled, I get this quantum computing benefit, is what I think you're saying. That doesn't sound easy. If I need superconducting materials to really do full-blast quantum computing. Or maybe I'm going way beyond superconducting. I can get a superconducting material at 77 Kelvin. But I think your Bose-Einstein state requires a micro and nano Kelvins. To do that on a medium-sized computer strikes me as currently very difficult. Over here, Roy, K2LAW.
I mean, you shouldn't get into the idea that a regular serial electronic CPU Intel-based chip, if you freeze it, if you cool it low enough, you get a quantum computer from it. It's a completely different architecture, and it has to do with quantum states in the registers. And in order to maintain the quantum states in the registers, you have to cool it down with liquid helium at very low temperatures. You don't have to bring it down enough for Bose-Einstein condensate, but you have to bring it really low down. And so it's expensive to buy, it's very expensive to maintain, and it's dubious whether it's doing much at this point. It's a matter of building the number of cells. It's sort of like in regular computers, originally microcomputers first came out, they were 4-bit devices, and at best, they made a decent adding machine, but not much else. And then they became 8-bits, and they got very useful. Then they became 16, and then 32, and now they're 64-bit. So they're dramatically different than their 4-bit forebears. The same thing with qubits. A 4-qubit quantum computer, you can't do much with. A 1,000-qubit, you might be able to break all the codes on all the banks.
If the individual qubits are simultaneously 1 and 0, that almost sounds like they do not have a defined state. If I had 9 of those things, and I'm trying to get the 9 digits of my Social Security number, and if every one of those digits is this simultaneous 1 and 0, At first, I don't see the advantage of doing that, doing a real computing to try to find out the, this guy used his social security number as his password. How do you confirm that when the states are not defined, per se? OD-ROY, K2IW.
I agree with you. Quantum computers aren't really designed for the symbol manipulation that serial computers are designed for. Quantum computers are designed to do complex modeling that has a very large number of variables. You know, I mean, we can do two-body kinetics in space. When we put a third body in, it just leads to chaos. It apparently, with qubits exist in superposition. So they can exist in more than one state, and you can have them run through the possible factors of the product of two prime numbers, and they'll be in a superposition of all those numbers, and then when you collapse the wave function, apparently, it gives you the product of two prime numbers, which if you try to do it on a regular serial computer, can take, in some cases, centuries if the prime numbers are big enough. So that's the theory. It goes back to the superposition that's capable in quantum mechanics that isn't in regular serial computers.
Two free bodies in space have a certain gravity between the two, and I can, in theory, define the position, velocity, acceleration, and whatever of those two bodies. And I've got a closed-form solution using Newtonian mathematics if I'm using a relatively small velocities. Add a third body, I no longer have a closed-form solution. Yet NASA did a beautiful job of navigating every one of those spacecraft in space with a multi-body problem. Even though they didn't have a closed-form solution, they got an answer that was good enough. Do you have a simple explanation for that one, Roy? AC2GS, K2IW.
I don't think anything is simple in mathematics. I've been reading through set theory that's been giving me a migraine. They found mathematical tricks that allow them to limit the errors sufficient that it wouldn't screw up their mission profile. Find the same thing with the equations for the Lagrange points. They only work if the difference between the two objects is a significant proportion. If they were, if the two masses in the two body for a Lagrange point, you wouldn't be able to calculate it accurately. It would be off by way too much using the equations that they derive in cases of where one of the bodies is much more massive than the other. So they discovered mathematical tricks that limit the error to an acceptable range, is the best way I could describe it.
So the usual Lagrange points, number 4 and 5, are considered very stable. I think you might be telling me that if there wasn't a very large difference between the primary and secondary body that's creating Lagrange point number 4 and 5, if there wasn't a very large difference between the two, like Earth and Sun, if they were close in mass to each other, would I therefore be saying that Lagrange point 4 and 5 are nowhere near as stable anymore? Is that one way of looking at it, Roy? K2IW?
I don't know if it destabilizes the Lagrange point or it renders the equation we use to calculate it completely wrong. Because I don't think there's a place where they've tested either or. The way it's usually described from my reading is that it's the mathematical derivation of the locations that are completely dependent upon these limitations of the difference of the masses of the two main bodies.
That's going to make it very difficult to create a space colony if you can't find a very stable place to put all those people in. Even if you've got enough supply ships, if you've got enough, I can't think of the name of the darn supply ships, Progress, enough Progress ships to keep giving them raw materials to keep them alive.
Most systems that we're working with don't have equal mass, except for maybe binary stars.
what's really crazy is that we go around a unary star. Our sun is not a binary. It turns out there are more binaries than unaries in the world, in the universe. I don't know if there's more trinaries than binaries, but there's definitely more binaries than unaries. And yet they're now discovering you can have a planetary system around either the individual elements or around the composite of binary. Kepler has found some of those. The Kepler telescope, as I understand, has found some of those. It's getting stranger and stranger. Over to you, Roy. KGRIW.
Yes, but it's nice when it gets strange, because then you have an opportunity to reevaluate what you're thinking and what your conclusions are, and you might learn something new. And the whole point of this exercise for me, as I'm sure for you, is to learn something new every day if you can. Anyway, let me ask a little puzzler for people kind enough to have stayed awake my talk. True or false? And Paul, if you want to join in, I'd be thrilled. True or false? There is a dirty picture scrawled from Andy Warhol sitting somewhere on the moon.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
There's a picture. I don't know if he drew it though, but one of the astronauts did have it with them.
Okay, yes indeed. Well, it's one of those things that you can't 100% proof. You can only kind of rely on people's truthfulness and the stories they tell. The way that the story goes is that some smart guy at NASA wanted to do something with art. And so he contacted a bunch of artists and asked them to scribble something. And the idea is that they would reduce it to a porcelain tile and place the porcelain tile on the moon someplace during one of the lunar landings. And one of the people that they contacted was Andy Warhol, who says he either drew a stylized initial of AW or a rocket ship, although if you look at the image and if you go to warhol.ac2gs.com, you'll see the image. It doesn't look that much like a rocket or like initials. It looks like a dirty scribble. Anyway, they didn't get approval from NASA, but some guy at NASA asked a friend who works at NASA, and somehow, supposedly, they put that tile on Apollo 12's lunar lander, and it's wedged someplace. So there is a dirty Andy Warhol picture on the moon, if you believe these people. Okay, well, that's my believe it or not for tonight. I have other things, but it's up to midnight, so Dick, if you want to do something a little different, and I'll save a couple of these things for next week.
I've got a crazy question that has occurred to me in some of the reading recently, and that is, roughly 5 billion years from now, our sun uses up its supply of hydrogen. Right now it's taking hydrogen molecules and converting them into helium molecules and getting a lot of energy out of that process. Eventually it runs out of hydrogen and it starts fusing helium into bigger molecules. But at that time the sun is going to puff out and get much larger, and it's going to engulf Mercury and Venus and almost engulf the Earth. If the sun gets larger in volume, when it goes from fusing hydrogen and it's now fusing helium, does that mean the helium fusion creates a larger amount of energy? Is that why it is puffing out? Over to you, Roy, K2LIW.
My guess is that you read that Scientific American article. I got my issue, I think, on Monday or Tuesday. You got yours before Sunday. I don't think it's higher energy. I think it's simply the internal pressures are different during that point, and gravity no longer contains it as well as it used to, and so you have the external pressure. I mean, there might be an increase in the internal energy that's producing more pressure going out, but I think it's also some gravitational effect as well. The two of them interact, and before you know it, the entire Earth is engulfed in part of the sun, which is not a good thing if you want to be alive.
The material of a sun will collapse toward the center if the nuclear fire goes out. If the heat of the fire that creates the diameter, so to speak, that combined with the total amount of mass that's there, the fact that you get a larger diameter does suggest the core is running hotter. And the core running hotter suggests you're getting more energy out of that process. Along these lines, here's another one. Fusing hydrogen into helium, you could say has a certain efficiency to that process. However, the whole reason you're doing it is to create heat. The usual definition of inefficiency is you have some waste heat. If I am fusing hydrogen into helium and I want to create heat, whether I'm creating heat from the helium molecules that I've created, or heat from the waste heat that I've wasted in the process, that's both in the right direction. From one point of view, the sun runs at 100% efficiency. Over to you, Roy, KQLIW.
Well, yeah, it depends upon what you want to define as the work you want to do. As long as you define the work that you want to do as thermal energy, you can build objects that are 100% efficient, because all of the excess energy can't be destroyed. You know, energy is neither created nor destroyed, just changed. And so it'll change into, quote, waste energy, which is thermal energy, which is what you wanted in the first place. So ultimately, if your reason for any transformation of energy is to produce heat, you can build them 100% efficient for that purpose.
In the case of the fusion going on in the center of the sun, the waste heat is going into solar activity. If you and I were building a internal combustion engine, which runs at a relatively low efficiency, and I'm doing it to generate heat, the mechanical engine I get out, I could run that into a set of disc brake mechanism that takes the mechanical engine, converts it into heat. And the energy given off from the cylinders as heat, that's also good heat. But I'm getting a byproduct. I'm getting a carbon dioxide mixture coming out. Had I burned the fuel directly to begin with, as opposed to putting it into the internal combustion engine, the amount of waste material I get out of it could be very different. So to make a machine of 100% efficiency thermally on Earth might be very difficult. But the sun does it in a way that it almost guarantees 100% thermal efficiency. Over to you, Roy. KQIW.
Repeater, timeout.
AC2GS. Well, again, we have a problem with semantics. We've discussed this before, efficiency. It depends how you want to describe efficiency. I could take the devil's advocate approach and say that you're not getting 100% conversion of hydrogen into heat because you're left behind with a helium atom. So that's less than 100% conversion of hydrogen to energy. So it's not 100% efficient if you think of it in those terms. The same way as if you don't completely combust a combustible product and the byproduct still has potential energy that has been unused. So you could make the same case for hydrogen and helium in a nuclear reaction, in a fusion reaction on the sun.
I just thought of this, another factor. In the case of that fusion going on in the center of the sun, an extremely large number of neutrinos are flying out of there, probably among other particles. And is that thermal energy that's giving me benefit? Maybe not. the neutrinos do some interesting things. I'll turn it over to you to do whatever you'd like, Roy. You got 6 minutes. AC2GS, K2LAW.
Okay. Neutrinos are interesting things. People didn't know if they had rest mass or a very, very low rest mass, and they figured out that they have a very, very low rest mass. And neutrinos is involved in, we were talking last week about the weak nuclear force and why it mediates radioactive decay. And it has to do with creating neutrinos. So it's part of that answer, but hopefully it's a more involved answer. I'd rather kind of save it for another day. But that's a good topic of the fact that if you turned off the weak nuclear force, the sun would basically go out. Because it operates both by the strong force, the electromagnetic force, and the nuclear force. And that's where neutrinos are involved. So we'll get back to neutrinos next time, but that's another source of loss in the efficiency. It's not a perfect system because there are byproducts. There is beta decay. Electrons are let loose, and neutrinos are let loose, and so it's a kind of a messy product. You get ion emissions in some cases. All kinds of fun stuff comes out of the sun. So it depends on how you describe it. If you purely describe it as the energy output, all heat, well, then it's 100% efficient. If you want to take in the concepts of mass energy, which is, you know, mass is energy, energy is mass, then you have problems because you have to deal with the residual mass of neutrinos and helium atoms in the mix, and then the efficiency drops. That's my 2 cents on efficiency.
Arguably one of the biggest neutrino detectors that we've built to date is the cubic kilometer neutrino array that's at the South Pole. They've sunk something like 800 individual tubes worth of vertical rods worth of photo multiplier tubes down into the very pure ice that you've got at the South Pole. So this cubic kilometer neutrino detector has been in operation now for a couple of years, I believe, and they have discovered a neutrino event. There was a neutrino that hit the middle of their detector, and the energy output of that particular neutrino is something like either 1,000 or 1,000,000 times greater than the energy you could get maximum out of the Large Hadron Collider. Mother Nature has created a super powerful neutrino that hit that detector. I think it's happened twice already. So something out there in space is awfully potent. Just like we get these gamma ray bursts that periodically put out an amount of energy as if the whole darn galaxy went supernova simultaneously. So what makes these gamma ray bursts so potent? What in the world made that super neutrino hit that neutrino detector in the South Pole? We're going to make some discoveries. There's going to be some surprises. Over to you, Roy, for any comment. K2LAW in the TechNet.
Well, all neutrinos were not born equal. The neutrinos that we're most used to are electron neutrinos. So those are the ones spewing out of the sun. They're going through all of our bodies, billions and billions of them a second. We don't feel them. And they don't interact at all with us. But there are tau neutrinos. There are other types of heavier, more powerful neutrinos out there, and that might be what you're alluding to. By the way, Rich, the UPS is telling you that the audio feed on Link goes up and down and up and down, and he finds it a little disjointing.
Yeah, because it's now connected by way of an internet connection, the amount of latency goes up and down also. Whenever you've got an internet connection between these two repeaters, the latency changes, the audio quality changes. It seems like the internet never stays constant. You hook up a particular site on the internet, and you think you're connected to that site continuously. I get the impression that the net keeps failing and reestablishing by a different path. That's my guess. What do you think, Roy? K2LAW?
That's the very nature of the Internet. The Internet does not have a definitive pathway. It goes around, it's designed to detect links that are broken, links that are too slow, and reroute itself packet by packet. And so a lot of times it will send packets in different places and reassemble themselves. So it's hit or miss. It's very changeable. So that's the ultimate underpinnings of the Internet. There's no hard line anywhere. It's all almost random.
We are a couple of seconds from the bewitching hour. That was TechNet number 1701. That was Science and Physics Report number 31. That was Space Report number 301. 73, you all. Bye-bye for now. And we'll settle the really big problems next week. Say some final words, Roy, and send it over to Paul for some final words. K2RW, clear but listening. Be kind to each other.
Very good. Thank you, Dick. And once again, if there's any subject you want me to cover, any question you want me to answer, any answer you want me to question, the address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. And for a list of the different links, I have one for the M drive, one for the Cold Atom Lab, and one for the Warhol Dirty Picture. It's all on roy.ac2gs.com. And you just click it and you go there. So I want to thank everyone for listening, those who participated, and have a great week, and over to you, Paul.
Okay, very good. And next week we'll be talking about the three people coming back from the International Space Station on Sunday. And that will be an American, a person from Japan, and a Russian. And then 3 days later, there'll be a launch from Kazakhstan. Three more people going up. Two Americans. One American, one fellow from Germany, and one from Russia. So, and the next important flight will be the Icon flight. And that will be a Pegasus launch from an LC-1011 plane. And that will study the ionosphere, one of our favorite topics. The ham radio. 73 will be here next week. Glad everybody was here. And happy Memorial Day. WS2NClear.
That roy.ac2gs.com, beautiful site. One of those entries doesn't work. That's the one where the speed of a baseball enter has been hit by a bat. On my computer, that's the only one that doesn't work, Roy. Bye-bye for now. K2RAW.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater.
Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Thank you.
2, the WQVL repeater. Amateur Radio Repeater System.